Chapter 11.
"What's left of all that now?" said Schwartz. "Already the colors have begun to run. The time sequence is blurred, the landscape has lost its contours. There's nothing left but a flat picture under changing light. Not even a coherent picture. It's more like disconnected images rising from the dark stream of memory. The hotel window, a bare shoulder, whispered words that hover in the air like ghosts. The light above the green rooftops, the smell of the river at night. The moon on the gray stone of Notre Dame. Her face, full of love and devotion. Another face in Provence and the Pyrenees. And then that last rigid face I had never seen before, trying to crowd out all the others, as though all the rest had been a mistake." He raised his head. Again his face had that tortured look, though he tried to force a smile into it. "What's left is in here," he said, pointing to his head. "And even in my mind it's no safer than a dress in a closet full of moths. That's why I'm telling you about it. You'll keep it safe. With you, there's no danger. Your memory won't try to wipe it away to save you as mine does to save me. With me, it's in bad hands. Even now, that last rigid face is crowding out the others like a cancer." His voice rose. "But those others were the real faces. They were our life, not that unknown, terrible last." "Did you stay on in Paris?" I asked.
"Georg came back once," said Schwartz. "He tried sentimentality, and he tried threats. I was out when he came. I didn't see him until he was leaving the hotel. He stopped me.
'You rotter,' he said under his breath. 'You're ruining my sister, but just wait. We'll catch up with you. In a few weeks, we'll have you both. And then, my friend, I'll attend to you personally. You'll get down on your knees to me and beg me to finish you off, if you can still speak.'"
"I can easily imagine that," I said.
"You can't imagine anything. If you could, you'd have stayed away. I'll give you one more chance. If my sister is back in Osnabrück in 3 days, I'll forget part of the score. In 3 days. Have I made myself plain?"
"You were never very subtle."
"Is that so? Well, just don't forget that my sister has to go back. You know that yourself, you swine. She's sick. Don't pretend you don't know it. You can't pull the wool over my eyes."
I stared at him. I didn't know whether he was making this up, whether it was true, or whether he was only repeating what Helen had told him when she had first wanted to go to Switzerland.
"No," I said. "I don't know anything of the sort."
"You don't, eh?
That's convenient, you liar. She needs a doctor, and in a hurry. Write Martins and ask him. He knows."
Two men, dark forms against the white daylight, were passing through the open door of the lobby.
"In 3 days," Georg said, "or you'll vomit out your goddamned soul ounce by ounce. I'll be back soon, in uniform."
The men were in the lobby now. He pushed between them and marched off. The two men passed around me and mounted the stairs. I followed them. Helen was standing at the window of her room.
"Did you meet him?" she asked.
"Yes. He says you've got to go home because you're sick."
She shook her head. "What he won't think up!"
"Are you sick?" I asked.
"Nonsense," she said. "I just made that up to get a passport."
"He says Martins knows it too."
Helen laughed. "Of course he knows, don't you remember? He wrote me when we were in Ascona. I arranged the whole thing with him."
"Then you're not sick, Helen?"
"Do I look sick?"
"No, but that doesn't prove a thing. You're really not sick?"
"No," she said impatiently. "Did Georg say anything else?"
"The usual threats.
What did he want of you?
The same. I don't think he'll come back.
What did he come for in the first place?
Helen smiled strangely. He thinks I belong to him. He thinks I have to do everything he says. He has always been that way, even when we were children. Brothers are often like that. He thinks he's acting for the good of the family. I hate him.
For that?
I hate him. That's enough. I told him so. But there's going to be war. He's sure.
We fell silent. The sound of traffic on the Quai du Grand Augustin seemed to grow louder. Behind the Palais de Justice, the spire of Saint-Chapelle rose into the clear sky. We heard the cries of the newsboys rising above the sound of motors as the cries of gulls rise above the roaring of the sea.
I won't be able to protect you, I said.
I know that.
You'll be interned.
What about you?
I shrugged my shoulders. They'll probably intern me, too.
We may be separated.
She nodded. French prisons are no rest homes.
And German prisons?
In Germany, you wouldn't be locked up.
I'm staying here, said Helen with a gesture of impatience. You've done your duty. You've warned me. Now forget about it. I'm staying. It has nothing to do with you. I simply won't go back.
I looked at her.
To hell with safety, she cried. I'm sick of being careful. I was fed up long ago.
I put my arm around her shoulder. That's easy to say, Helen. She pushed me away.
Leave me then, she screamed. Go away and you won't be responsible. Leave me alone. Leave me. I can manage alone.
She looked at me as if I were Georg.
Stop acting like a mother hen. You don't understand a thing. Stop smothering me with your worries and your fear of responsibility. I didn't leave on your account. Try to get that through your head. It wasn't on account of you. I left for my own sake.
I know that. She came back to me.
You've got to believe me, she said gently. In spite of appearances, I had to leave. It was only an accident that you turned up. You've got to understand, safety isn't everything.
That is true, I said. But you want it for others if you love them.
There is no such thing as safety, she said. Don't contradict me. I know. I know better than you. I've thought the whole thing over. You'll never know how much I've thought about it. Let's not discuss it any more, my darling. The evening is waiting for us. There won't be many more for us in Paris.
If you won't go back to Germany, what about Switzerland?
Georg says the Nazis are going to overrun Switzerland the way the Kaiser overran Belgium in the First World War.
Georg doesn't know everything.
Let's stay here for the present. Maybe the whole thing is a lie. How can he know exactly what's going to happen? It looked like war before, and then came Munich. Why shouldn't there be a second Munich?
I didn't know whether she believed what she was saying, or was only trying to ease my mind. It's so easy to believe what falls in with your hopes. That's what I did that evening. How could France go to war? It wasn't prepared. It had to give in. Why should the French go to war for the Poles? They hadn't raised a finger for Czechoslovakia. 10 days later, the borders were closed. The war had begun.
Were you arrested right away, Mr. Schwartz? I asked.
We had another week. We were forbidden to leave the city. It was ironic. For 5 years they had been throwing me out. Then all of a sudden they wouldn't let me leave.
Where were you?
In Paris, I said. Were you shut up in the Velodrome too?
Of course.
I don't recall your face.
There were hundreds of refugees in the Velodrome, Mr. Schwartz.
Do you remember the last few days before war was declared, when Paris was blacked out? Yes, of course. It was as though the world had gone dark.
The little blue lights on street corners, said Schwartz. They reminded me of night lights in hospitals. In that cold blue darkness, the whole city seemed to be sick. The shivers ran through you. I thought we'd better have some ready cash and sold one of Schwartz's drawings. It was a bad time to be selling. The dealer I went to offered me a pittance. I turned it down and took the drawing back. Finally, I sold it to a rich refugee, somebody formerly connected with the movies in Germany. He distrusted the currency and was buying up everything he could lay hands on. I left my last drawing with the hotel owner for safekeeping. Then the police came for me. It was in the afternoon. There were two men. They told me to say goodbye to Helen. She stood there, pale, with flashing eyes. It's not possible, she said. Yes, it is, I said. It's perfectly possible. They will come for you later. We'd better not throw our passports away. Keep yours, too. That's right, said one of the policemen in good German. Better hold on to them. Thank you, I answered. Can you leave us alone to say goodbye? The policeman looked toward the door. If I had wanted to run away, I could have done it several days ago, I said. He nodded. I went with Helen to her room. When it really happens, I said, it's not the same as when you're just talking about it. And I took her in my arms. She broke away. How will I get in touch with you? We had the usual last-minute discussion. We had two addresses, the hotel and in care of a French friend. The policeman knocked at the door. I opened. Take a blanket with you, he said. It will only be a day or two, but take a blanket anyway and something to eat. I haven't got a blanket.
I'll bring you one, said Helen.
She quickly packed up what edibles we had on hand.
Is it really only for a day or two? She asked.
At the most, said the policeman. Just to check your identity and that kind of thing.
C'est la guerre, madame.
We were often to hear that. Schwartz took a cigarette from his pocket and lighted it. You know how it was. The wait at the police station, other refugees pouring in, rounded up as if they were dangerous Nazis. The ride in the paddy wagon to the prefecture, the endless wait at the prefecture. Were you in the Salle Lépine, too? I nodded. The Salle Lépine was a large room at the prefecture, a kind of movie theater, where they ordinarily showed training films for the police. There was a screen and a few hundred seats. I spent 2 days there, I answered. At night they took us to a big coal cellar with benches to sleep on. In the morning we looked like chimney sweeps. We sat on those chairs for days, said Schwartz. We were filthy. It wasn't long before we looked like the criminals they took us for. Georg had his revenge on me, though he hadn't planned it. It was through the prefecture that he had learned our address. Someone had consulted the files for him. He had made no secret of his party membership. That was brought up now. They thought I was a spy. I was questioned 4 times a day about my relations with Georg and the National Socialist Party. At first, I laughed. It was too absurd. But then I discovered that absurdities can be very dangerous. Take the party in Germany. And now, under the impact of bureaucracy and war, even France, the land of reason, seemed to have gone mad. Without knowing it, Georg had left a time bomb behind him. It's no joke to be taken for a spy in wartime. Every day new batches of terrified people were brought in. Not one man had been killed at the front. This was la drôle de guerre, as the wits called it. But an atmosphere of war had settled over the country like a plague. The life and welfare of the individual counted for nothing. People had ceased to be human beings.
They were classified according to military criteria as soldiers, fit for military service, unfit for military service, and enemies. By the third day in the Salle Lepine, I was thoroughly exhausted. Some of our number had been taken away. The rest were engaged in whispered conversation, sleeping, or eating. Life was reduced to the barest essentials. Still, we were not too downcast. Compared to a German concentration camp, this was nothing. At the worst, you might be kicked or pushed a little if you were slow in responding to orders. But power is power, and a policeman is a policeman the world over. I was very tired from all the questioning. Under the screen on the platform, our armed guards sat in a row with legs outstretched. The dimly lighted room, the bare, soiled screen, and we down below, a dismal picture that seemed to symbolize life itself. You were always either a prisoner or a guard, free only to decide what kind of film you wanted to see on the empty screen, an educational film, a comedy, or a tragedy. Ultimately, there was nothing but this empty screen, a hungry heart, and the stupid representatives of power, who behaved as if they were eternal and always right, though the screens had been blank for years. It would always be like this, I thought. Nothing would ever change. One day I'd disappear and no one would be the wiser. You know those hours, when hope dies. You've been through it. I nodded. The hour of silent suicide. Your resistance is gone. You take the last step without thinking, almost by accident. The door opened, Schwartz went on, and with the yellow light from the corridor, Helen came in. She had a basket and a couple of blankets and was carrying a leopard skin coat over her arm. I recognized her by her walk and by the way she carried her head. She stood still for a moment. Then she passed down the rows, searching. She passed close to me and did not see me. It was almost like the time in the Osnabrück Cathedral. "Helen," I said. She turned around. I stood up. She looked at me. "What have they done to you?" she asked angrily. "Nothing much. We sleep in a coal cellar. It's bad for the complexion. How did you get here?" "I've been arrested," she said with a note of pride, "just like you, and much sooner than the other women. I was hoping to find you here." "Why did they arrest you? Why did they arrest you?" "They think I'm a spy." "Me too, because my passport is in order." "How do you know that?" "I've just been questioned. They told me so. I'm not a bona fide refugee. They haven't arrested the women yet. A little man with pomade on his hair told me." "Is he the one who questions you? He smells of snails." "I don't know. Everything smells of snails in this place. Thank God you've brought blankets." "I brought all I could." Helen opened the basket. Two bottles clinked. "Cognac," she said. "No wine. It's the strength that counts. How's the food?" "About what you'd expect. They let us send out for sandwiches." Helen bent down and inspected me. "You look like a cargo of African slaves. Can't you wash?" "Not so far. But it's not meanness, just disorder." She took out the cognac. "The corks have been pulled," she said. "The hotel keeper did it. He was very kind. He said I wouldn't find a corkscrew here. Have a drink." I took an enormous gulp and passed the bottle back to her. "I even have a glass," she said. "It's my tribute to civilization. Let's keep it up while we can." She filled the glass and drank. "You smell of summer and freedom," I said. "What's it like on the outside?" "Like peacetime. The cafes are full, the sky is blue." She looked at the row of policemen on the platform and laughed.
It makes me think of a shooting gallery. You shoot at those dummies up there, and if one of them tips over, you get a bottle of wine or an ashtray. Here it's the dummies that have the guns. Helen fished into her basket and produced a pâté. From the patron, she said, with best greetings and a message. Mère de la guerre. It's pâté de volatile. I've got forks and a knife. I say it again. Vive la civilisation. Suddenly I felt gay. Helen was there. Nothing was lost. There was still no fighting, and maybe it was true that we would soon be released. The following afternoon we heard that we were going to be separated. I would be sent to the transit camp in Colombes, Helen to La Petite Roquette prison. Even if they had believed we were married, it wouldn't have helped. Married couples were separated too. We sat up all night in the cellar with the permission of a kind-hearted guard. Someone had brought a few candles. Some of our number had already been shipped out. There were still about 100 of us left. Quite a few Spanish refugees, too. There was something ironical about the thoroughness with which anti-fascists were being rounded up in an anti-fascist country. It made you think of Germany. "Why do they want to separate us?" Helen asked. "I don't know. It's not cruelty, just stupidity."
"If they put men and women in the same camp," said a little old Spaniard, "there'd be nothing but jealousy and fights. That's why you're being separated. C'est la guerre!"
Helen slept beside me in her leopard coat. There were a few comfortable padded benches, but they had been set aside for some elderly women. One of them offered Helen her bench to sleep on from 3 to 5. She refused. "I'll have plenty of time to sleep alone later on," she said. It was a weird night. The voices gradually died down. The old women stopped whimpering. Now and then one of them would wake up sobbing, but soon drift off into sleep as though smothered in black wool. The candles went out one by one. Helen slept on my shoulder. She put her arms around me in her sleep. And when she woke up, she whispered to me. Sometimes she spoke like a child, and sometimes like a woman in love. Words that people don't say in the daytime, or even at night under normal circumstances. Words of suffering and parting. Words of the body, which rebels against parting. Words of the skin, of the blood. Words of plaint. The oldest plaint in the world. Why can't we stay together? Why must one always go first? Why is death forever tugging us by the hand, making us move on, even when we are tired, even when we are trying for one short hour to keep up the illusion of eternity? Later her head slid slowly down my shoulder to my knees. I held her head in my hands and saw her breathing in the light of the last candle. I heard men stand up and grope their way among the piles of coal, looking for a place to urinate. The feeble light flickered and enormous shadows danced about. Then the last light went out, and there was nothing but stuffy snoring darkness. Once she started up with a short high-pitched cry. "I'm here," I whispered. "Don't be frightened. Everything is all right." She lay back and kissed my hands. "Yes, you're here," she murmured. "Stay with me always." "I'll always be with you," I whispered. "Even if we're separated for a little while, I'll always find you." "You'll find me?" she murmured, slipping into sleep. "I'll always find you. Always. Wherever you are. Same as I found you last time." "That's good," she sighed, and turned her face so that it rested in my hands as in a bowl. I didn't sleep. From time to time I felt her lips on my fingers, and once I thought I felt tears. But I said nothing. I loved her very much, and it seemed to me that I had never loved her more, even when possessing her, than in this sordid night full of snoring, punctured by the strange hissing sound of urine falling on coal. I was very still. Myself was extinguished by love. Then came the morning, the pale early grayness that steals every color away and discloses the skeleton under the skin. Suddenly it seemed to me that Helen was dying, and that I must wake her to keep her alive. She awoke and opened an eye. "Do you think we could get some coffee and croissants?" she asked. I was filled with happiness. "I'll try to bribe one of the guards," I said. Helen opened her other eye and looked at me. "What has happened?" she asked. "You look as if you'd won first prize in the lottery. Are we going to be released?" "No," I said. "I've released myself." She moved her head sleepily in my hands. "Can't you give yourself any peace?" "Yes," I said, "I'll have to, in fact. For quite a while, I'm afraid. I won't have much chance to make my own decisions. It's a comfort if you look at it that way."
"Everything's a comfort," said Helen with a yawn. "As long as we live, everything is comforting. Didn't you know that? Do you think they will shoot us as spies?"
"No, they'll lock us up."
"Will they lock up the refugees they don't regard as spies?"
"Yes, they'll arrest everyone they lay hands on. They've arrested the men already."
Helen half raised herself. "What's the difference then?"
"Maybe the others will be let out sooner."
"You can never tell. Maybe we'll get better treatment just because they take us for spies."
"That's nonsense, Helen."
She shook her head. "It's not nonsense, it's experience. Don't you know that in this century innocence is the worst crime, and that the innocent are always punished and the most severely? It seems to me you'd know that after being arrested in two countries. You and your dreams of justice. Is there any more cognac?"
"Cognac and pâté."
"Give me both," said Helen. "It's an odd breakfast, but I'm afraid we have an adventurous life ahead of us."
"That's a good way to look at it," I said, and gave her the cognac.
"It's the only way. Would you rather die of bitterness? Once you discard the idea of justice, it's not so hard to take the whole business as an adventure. Don't you agree?"
The glorious smell of the old cognac and the succulent pâté hovered around Helen like an aura of happiness. She ate with gusto. "I didn't know it would be so simple for you," I said.
"Don't worry about me," she said, taking some white bread from her basket. "I'll get by. Justice doesn't mean as much to women as to you."
"What do women care about?"
"This."
She pointed to the bread and the cognac and the pâté.
"Eat, darling. We'll come through all right. In 10 years it will be a great adventure, and we'll tell our friends about it until they are bored stiff. Eat, man with the false name. What we eat now, we won't have to carry later on."
"I won't tell you all the details," said Schwartz. "You know how it was with the refugees. I only spent a few days in the stadium at Colombes. Helen was sent to La Petite Roquette. On the last day, our hotel keeper turned up in the stadium. I only saw him from a distance. We weren't allowed to speak to visitors. The patron left a small cake and a large bottle of cognac. In the cake I found a note. 'Madame is well and cheerful. She is not in danger. Expects to be sent to a women's camp that is being set up in the Pyrenees. Write via hotel. Madame est formidable.' Folded up inside was a tiny note in Helen's handwriting. 'Don't worry, the danger is past. It's still an adventure. See you soon, love.'" She had succeeded in breaking the blockade, a very sloppy blockade, but still, I couldn't imagine how. She told me about it later. She had carried on about some important papers left behind in her room, and they had sent her to the hotel with a policeman. She had slipped the patron the note and told him in a whisper how to deliver it. The policeman, who had a soft spot for lovers, had closed an eye. She had brought back no papers, but perfume, cognac, and a basket full of food instead. She loved to eat. I was never able to understand how she managed to stay slim. When, in the days of our freedom, I woke up and found her place in bed empty, I only had to go to the corner where we kept our food. She would be sitting there with a blissful smile in the moonlight, gnawing at a ham bone or stuffing on some dessert she had saved from dinner, and drinking wine out of the bottle. She was like a cat that gets hungry at night. The patron, she told me, was just baking the pâté when she was arrested. She had made the policeman wait till it was done. It was her favorite kind of pâté, and she just had to take it along. She flatly refused to go without it. The policeman had grumbled but capitulated. They dislike dragging people to the paddy wagon. Helen even remembered to take a package of paper napkins. Next day we were loaded into cars headed for the Pyrenees. This was the beginning of an epic of terror, comedy, escape, bureaucracy, despair, and love.